Last year, Adam and I and a few hundred friends of DeSoto gathered in the Masonic Lodge inside a cemetery in the heart of Hollywood. Were we there to practice some dark rite? Some sinister ritual designed to bring deceased Star Trek actors back to the plane of the living? To bring an unholy horde of undead nerd celebrities to Earth to consume the brains of the living? No, we were just doing our live show of the Share Your Embarrassment Tour. It's our review of Star Trek V, and we filmed it. We just wanted to let you know to get ready for that live stream announcement coming next week. If you're a Max Fun member and you support our shows, you'll get access to discounted tickets from membership at MaximumFun.org. So, good time to make sure those emails are delivering properly to your inbox. Either way, we'll be announcing ticket links soon here and on our mailing list that you can sign up for at podshop.biz. The Share Your Embarrassment Tour is coming to your living room for one last stop, and you're not going to want to miss it.
Captain?
Not here.
Captain?
Report.
Signatures detected.
Shields up.
Signatures detected.
Red alert.
Context Starfleet Command.
What's happening?
Context Starfleet Command.
Delay that order.
Context Starfleet Command.
This is the captain.
Context Starfleet Command.
Get out of my chair. Chair.
We have engaged the Klingons.
Klingons?
Welcome to The Greatest Discovery. It's a new Star Trek podcast from the makers of The Greatest Generation. I'm Adam Pranica.
I'm Ben Harrison.
The new Star Trek today is the halfway point. It's episode 5 of Star Trek Picard.
Yeah, it sure is. Adam, did you know that there is a novel that tells the story of the Romulan evacuation?
Is this the novel that I saw in the airport a couple days ago with Picard on the cover?
Yeah, it's called Picard, The Last Best Hope by Una McCormick.
How about that?
Would you be surprised to hear that I have consumed this novel recently and have some thoughts?
I mean, I would be surprised, not that you would be interested or that you would do it. It's that the thing that I'm most surprised about is that you would have the free time to. So, well, congratulations.
A number of events conspired to make this possible. I had to go to the Bay Area for a funeral over the weekend.
Mm-hmm. You and I were both funeral buddies recently.
Yeah.
When you're co-host with someone, so many of your things start to sync up.
Yeah. All the deaths in your family start to...
Right.
start to happen at the same time.
That's what people don't tell you when you start doing a podcast with someone.
Yeah. I don't know why we were surprised. We were texting like, hey, man, I was just at a funeral today. Pretty bummed out. Oh, yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I was, I had to do it as a drive, and I happened to be looking at my books app on my phone, and I noticed then in the audiobook section, this book, and the drive from my house to where the funeral was about 5.5 hours. The book, 11 hours.
Oh, you could crush that.
I'd be a fool not to take this time to take this book down in audiobook form. My first ever audiobook.
And using that equation, you wouldn't even have to go 1.5 time, like the monsters out there who speed listen to podcasts.
Yeah.
I have to ask this question, Ben, and I'm going to hate it as soon as I put it out there, but is it canon?
I don't know. I mean, there are things that are planted in this book that were paid off in this episode in a way that make me think that it is all but canon, but I don't know. Yeah, like I would recommend reading it in between episode 5 and episode 6 if somebody is like precious about spoilers.
Huh. All right. Well timed then.
You learn some stuff that you know, you'd have privileged knowledge of what's going on before now.
Is there one person reading the whole thing, or is it read by the actors, or is it read by different actors?
It's read by somebody named Robert Petkoff, who I think has done audiobooks for other Star Trek books, and he actually had like a pretty decent Picard voice.
Choose your course wisely now.
That's great.
Yeah, and I thought he actually like was pretty great at it.
Picard seems really hard to do. I mean, you and I do it terribly.
Yeah.
We know that.
he's not nailing it. It's not an impression. It just gets closer to Picard than the way he reads Agnes Girardi, for example. Like, it basically starts when the Federation learns about the supernova and roughly ends with the Federation deciding to stop attempting to rescue the Romulans.
So it stops at the Mars attack?
Right. So, okay. Yeah, like it's like the Mars attack and like the, you know, immediate aftermath of that. And that's the end. So it's a bit of a bummer, I will say. But there's some interesting and fun details. Like, one of the earliest things that happens in the conversation about Picard getting the job of being in charge of the Romulan spacelift is who is going to become the captain of the E.
Yeah.
Any guesses on who gets that gig, Adam?
Who gets the captain of the E job? Just the way you ask the question makes me want to go away from the obvious. Beverly?
It is Captain Worf. Survey says Captain Worf is the new captain of the E.
Wow.
This is done partly because Picard argues that he's the person in line that deserves it most, and partly because there's a sort of a political message, like the Klingons used to be our enemies, and now a Klingon is the captain of our flagship.
Wow.
One of the characters in the book is the Romulan space scientist who discovered the supernova, and he is, like, definitely... I don't think explicitly written this way, but I think definitely kind of autism spectrum kind of character. Mm-hmm. And is very focused on his work and not on the comings and goings of the world around him. And his story is very tragic and sad.
Wow.
A couple of things we learn about Agnes Girardi in this book, because she is one of the main characters.
Right.
She's actually an MD. Before she came to work at the Daystrom Institute with Maddox, she had a medical degree. So,
interesting.
So Dr. Girardi may be on the path to being a doctor. One thing we learned in this episode is that she had a bit of a romance with Maddox.
Yeah.
One thing that they go into great detail in the book is that she was, like, fairly crucial in the development of the synths. And the synths were developed specifically to man the shipyards at Utopia Planitia because they had a problem of not having enough people to build the amount of ships that they needed to rescue the number of Romulans that they needed to rescue.
Right.
So, which I think is an interesting detail because there's a lot of sci-fi about, like, machines rising up because they are, in fact, slaves. And mm-hmm. This book is very careful to describe them as non-sentient. And there's a lot of people that suspect some sort of foul play was involved with why they flipped, specifically Raffi. And Raffi is, like, probably the saddest character in the book because she is in Romulan intelligence at the beginning of the book and gets kind of tapped on the shoulder to be Picard's number one in the mission, which takes years and years. Like, the book spans, you know, 4 or 5 years or something like that. And over that 4 or 5 years, she's out in Romulan space warping around with Picard while her husband and son are back at home. And basically her marriage is crumbling and her relationship with her son is ending over the course of the book. And
jeez.
That's a pretty tough thing, but I don't know. And then there's this whole element of, like, the Federation Council. Like, one of the main characters is a member of the Federation Council who's, like, newly elected from a border world who resents the fact that Starfleet is mobilizing all these resources to save the Romulans when border worlds don't necessarily get everything that that, like, big planets in the center of the Federation get.
Wow.
So there's, like, you know, some modern comparisons to be made in terms of, like, grievances about immigrants and the, you know, like, when Picard starts, you know, bringing ships full of Romulan refugees across the neutral zone to you know, there are worlds that are like more and less receptive to having refugees on them. And when that starts happening, like he basically like unilaterally ends the neutral zone in the novel. And that becomes like this huge political football and winds up being a big part of why the Federation is prepared to just stop the mission when the Mars attack happens.
Wow. Yeah. Like the dissolution of the neutral zone is a plot point in this episode.
Yeah.
Also, it's interesting. Is there much cutting back to the E with Worf in command? Like, who's his XO?
Well, that like they want the E nowhere near any of this situation because the E is a provocative ship in the minds of Romulans. So Picard's like when he's offered the job, he's like, cool, let me get back to the E. I'm going to get started right away. And they're like,
no. Drive it around with its nose smashed in as a message.
Yeah. No mention of the Remans in the book at all, which I thought was surprising. I wonder whatever happened to those guys. Remember.
It sounds like it was worth reading or listening to.
I really liked it. I think Una McCormick is a good writer. It's very like it makes you think a lot about, you know, like I think that all of the issues are like very obviously kind of a sci-fi version of a modern issue, which is like not always attractive to me. Like I do really like the part of Star Trek where it's like, hey, it's a socialist post-scarcity utopia where the problems are like super different and unrelatable.
Right. It's nice to just turn off your present day mind a little bit.
Yeah. But this, like, I think to its credit, really made you see the humanity in people that made a different call about a thing than you probably would.
Yeah.
I think people would like it. This is the first Star Trek book I have ever read, aside from the comic books we read occasionally on this show.
What?
Yeah.
Man, I was the kind of nerd that read Star Trek The Next Generation books from the time that they started making them.
Yeah.
I read the first 20 books.
Wow.
In school, and it was one of the main reasons that I was ostracized the way that I was.
I mean, you tell yourself that.
I was reading many grade levels higher than my actual grade, and I chose to read Star Trek books.
Well, you may not choose to read this one because Jaban and Laris are not really in it at all.
Oh, fuck that.
But you know who is Zani. She is like a big recurring character. And
cool.
She's described as kind of like one of the only people Picard meets in all of his dealings with Romulans that is like a kindred spirit.
Well, you and I both know I have a great big drive down the coast coming up, and this sounds like something I'd like to listen to for part of that. I think that'd be time well spent. So I'm gonna listen to it.
Oh, cool. If only an audiobook company would sponsor our program.
Yeah.
That'd be nice.
Someday.
Yeah. Do you want to get into the episode we came to review here today, Adam?
Sure do, Bennett. It's Star Trek Picard, Season 1, Episode 5, Stardust City Rag.
This is a Frakes episode, and Frakes loves to open a Star Trek thing on extremely brutal eye trauma. and this episode is no exception.
Yeah, it's really true. I looked at the crew list for this episode and realized that its editor had a bunch of reps in this season of Star Trek Picard, also a number of eps on Star Trek Discovery, and crucially was an editor of a couple of Saw films.
Wow.
And that really made a lot of sense in context.
Boy, I shot a documentary about maternal health care one time, and I was in the OR and filmed a cesarean section operation. And filming it, I was fine. And I was like worried going in because I had never like been in an operating room before or, you know, been around much blood or whatever.
It's the one place you don't want to get an erection.
Well, they put scrubs on you, so it's pretty easy to hide behind all the kind of drapey fabric. But editing that footage was very hard for me because...
I bet. You want to use a down resolution proxy,
yeah.
Ideally, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Go 480 on that.
It was much harder to edit than it was to shoot. And I've always thought about that, like the layer of abstraction makes a big difference.
The editor of this episode is Andrew Coote, whose last name is the same as Emily Coote, the actor on Star Trek Discovery. I couldn't find anything that indicated they were family. Interesting coincidence there. She plays Detmer.
Oh.
Detmer to Owo. She's the D to the Dowo. Man.
Wow. This is Ichib getting his eye extracted. It's a Borg eye.
Black eye, like a doll's eye.
Which we discover when it comes out and we see that it's connected by electrical cables to the inside of his head.
Now, it doesn't look like there's a grounding cable on this Borg eye. We're going to want to remove it and install a proper receptacle so it's code approved.
First, we're going to go around to the back, find the breaker, and turn off the entire circuit. That way, we'll be safe from electrocution as we dismantle this living bug.
I, Ben, have not watched any of Star Trek Voyager, but what I know about Ichib is that he's sort of the Wesley of that show, right? Like he entered kind of midstream and became sort of a beloved character.
He's a late-breaking Wesley.
Yeah.
I think what I remember is that after Seven of Nine has been around for a while, they come across some kid Borgs that they're able to be Borg. And then, you know, they're able actually to find their original families or their original species, but others they're not. And Ichib comes back with them.
Ichib is in such bad shape that he asks Seven to take him to a farm to live out the rest of his days.
Yeah, well, he's going to be much happier there. There's a lot of room to run around. And
yeah, pretty dark tone setter for this ep.
Yeah, indeed. And it's punctuated by Seven basically, referring to Ichib as her child.
There's a gleeful counterpoint to this scene where, like, the surgeon is almost happily dismembering him. Like, the surgeon has a personality about it that was disturbing. And also that outshot revealing kind of a coat hanger full of Borg body parts there. I mean, this is a facility that did a lot of this.
Right. Purpose built for taking Borgs apart. And there's been some talk of that being something that the Romulans are up to as well.
Right.
Although they seem to be doing it in a more humane way. But I'm wondering what people are doing with these Borg parts.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you definitely get a sense that they have great value in this time, but unclear as to exactly how or why. This was 13 years ago.
Yeah.
So we're going to bounce around through time a little bit in this episode. I think it's also interesting to me that the planet was called Vergessen, which is German for forget.
Huh.
Like in a German version of this episode, are they going to call that something else? Or is that what it's supposed to be called?
I don't know.
Yeah.
No surprise what the Germans get up to when they get out into space.
Oh, geez. Come on. Not all Germans, Ben. That's what I'd say. So we move ahead in time. We are now 2 weeks in the past of what current time is on the Star Trek Picard show. We're now on Free Cloud, and specifically the Stardust City Bar. There we meet Vajazzle and Mr. Vup. And this got to be... I know how it's spelled, and I also know how it sounds. How is this not a temporary name that snuck through? Vajazzle? Really?
Yeah. Is Bejazzle or Vajazzle worse? Let's try and hit right in the middle of those two.
I mean, what's great about her name and her appearance is that she's wearing the flesh colored cat suit that's covered with little gems. I mean, you could assume that the name is accurate, right?
She gives big Dabo girl vibes, but she's running a sinister criminal empire from what we can tell.
Yeah. Mr. Vup being her heavy. He might as well be Random Task here.
Who throws a shoe?
I really liked her costumes. I thought like the materials and like she has like at one point she has like a huge collar that's like super mm-hmm. three-dimensional and see-through so you can see like all the structure in it. And I just thought that was like really like next level spacey costume work, you know?
Yeah, I think the costume tech has come a long way from a show like TNG.
Yeah, it's just like put them in like a baseball shirt that's made out of glittery fabric.
Right. Or something that's so form-fitting that it's almost pornographic. Like right. You can see inside of a person. Like that was a mistake that was made in TNG also.
Yeah.
It's good. And it's tasteful for what it is.
Yeah. We actually meet Maddox in this scene. He narrowly escaped his lab as it was being molecularly destroyed by the Tal Shiar. Bejazel, you know, makes a show of taking pity on him, but really she is interested in selling him to the Tal Shiar because the Tal Shiar want him. A little unclear what their relationship was prior to that.
This is not throwing any shade at all at John Ailes portraying Bruce Maddox here, but for a moment, were you expecting and disappointed in the idea that we didn't get a Brian Brophy here reprising his role?
I was a little disappointed. I wonder why it wasn't.
I wonder why too. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if there's any story to it. I think many times, like, I looked at Brian Brophy's IMDb, like it does not appear that he is a working actor as of the last 6 years. So maybe he just retired. Hmm. Maybe he's not in the game anymore. And that's all it was.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, maybe it was a logistics thing. I think that the guy they got was, it, you know, looks the part.
Hard agree. Yeah.
It's not like one of those like ones where they just recast a role with somebody that's like, that doesn't look anything like the person that we're talking about.
Again, like I bring it up not to criticize the choice, but to also say like this is a show that sort of relishes in its surprise, we brought back the real person effect very often. And this is, I think, one of the choices they made in not doing that. And I think it's worth interrogating.
Yeah.
Because you are conscious of your existence and actions.
She pulls a trick beverage on him and he passes out. And she says they're going to have to cut a deal with the Tal Shiar for this guy.
You don't want to drink Cosby's on Planet Free Cloud.
We come back from the opening credits with Picard in his chateau watching some promo for Free Cloud, mm-hmm. which is pornographic enough that he's like, quickly trying to scramble to close the window when Seven of Nine comes in.
Right.
Like, I'm just looking up some YouTube videos. I don't know how that popped up.
It's suggested later on that Free Cloud targets its advertisements to you to such a degree that it knows your interests.
Yeah.
And what you may be into. Like, it's just, Admiral Picard, has it been a while since you felt a full and large erection? Would you like to, nearly consequence-free?
Free Cloud has the facilities to help you achieve that, and also doctors to see if your erection lasts longer than 4 hours.
It's cool. I like this little ready room that Picard's got. He seems to have some mixed feelings about it. Seven kind of makes fun of the environment.
Yeah. You know, she's kind of one of these people who has an opinion of Picard. He's got a rep that he is living with. And this is not an episode where Picard is in the ball kicking machine.
Right.
It's not the ep where he's going around apologizing to everybody for something.
Yeah.
And I think the like nuanced version of that backstory that you get from the book that I read has helped me understand that a lot more. But I like that Seven is like aware of it and kind of flips the you're a quitter shit at him, but not to the extent that she's like got zero respect for him or anything. And when she finds out that he's out here doing something selfless, that's not about like adding to his legend or digging himself out of a hole or whatever. It does kind of, you can see something turn in her. She's surprised and intrigued by what he says.
Yeah, there's no like greater glory associated with what's happening here. And there's sort of a mutual respect in this scene too. Like Picard has complicated feelings about the Fenris Rangers, but ultimately comes down on the side of respecting the game. Like this is an area of space, and getting back to the idea of there not being a neutral zone anymore, like it's an area that doesn't really have any laws or order. And in the absence of that, the Rangers sort of act as a militia, enforcing their own sense of justice to things out there. And this is something that Picard can get with. They don't appear to be like Maquis adjacent in the way that Picard would definitely not like, you know?
No, I got the sense she's much more like a sheriff's deputy in a Western kind of a character.
Right. Yeah.
And I'll take another one of these.
This is a really fun scene because there's two things happening simultaneously. There's Seven and Picard getting reacquainted, and there's also Raffi and Rios talking about how weird it is that there are two XBs on their ship conspiring in another room.
Yeah.
And Rios's epiphany happened at almost the same time as mine, which is like, as much as we make fun of Picard for being an ex-Borg and being responsible for the many atrocities that occurred as Locutus, like there are still people who have to live and work around him with that knowledge.
Right.
And that's gotta feel weird.
It hit me like, oh, like people are watching this show that haven't watched TNG or Voyager. Yeah. Or one or the other or both, you know, like the show can't assume you know anything about these characters, you know?
There's such a like great amount of creative tension in the whole thing, because there's that, and there's also the desire that the viewer has for these two characters to relate to each other in the obvious way.
And to start fucking and make XB babies.
Like, Picard has been alone in the universe for so long in his experience, and here is the one person that can relate to him on that very specific level. Yeah. Of trying to get over the great trauma that they have, and they don't give you that here.
Yeah.
It makes you wait, and I think that's good.
I agree. We see a little home video from a time that Dr. Girardi and her boo, Bruce Maddox, made some chocolate chip cookies together. It's always a cute hang.
I was way off about what I thought their relationship would be. When they started smooching, I was like, what? No. Oh.
I wondered if we were going to, because like I read that book, or I listened to that book like before we saw this, and uh-huh. I wondered if I was going to have to like withhold that knowledge when we talked about this episode, because
right.
Like they definitely start their relationship kind of in a like professor-student orientation.
Yeah.
Which is fucking wild. Like it's very uncomfortable.
I mean, you read the book. What did it start from, a like Bruce Bangs as TA kind of experience, or was it just like two coworkers by virtue of all the time spent together eventually get close?
You know, he has to teach grad students as part of his gig at the Daystrom Institute, mm-hmm. and he thinks they're all bozos who are just, you know, taking his class to get the credit so that they can get on with their careers. And she's the only one that actually like really cares about the area of Android research he's interested in.
Right.
And so they start like getting coffee together and
yeah,
and slowly fall in love over the course of...
You start taking your breaks with someone, I think that starts you off on the path.
Yeah. And she's like starstruck when she first meets him, but then gets to snogging with him eventually.
Bruce Maddox may be a genius when it comes to cybernetics, but he did not brown his butter for those chocolate chip cookies, Ben, and you and I both know.
Yeah.
They're just not going to be as good. I wonder if there is an analog to that when it comes to his synths. Did he not brown their butter first? Is that why they went on the killing spree? That's
yeah.
My film paper.
Yeah. When you get... When you get one of those too light of color chocolate chip cookies, you can tell that the Conclave of Eight had something to do with that.
Who are the Conclave of Eight? Like the Pentaveret from So I Married an Axe Murderer? It's like the 24th century colonel.
Oh, you're going to buy my chicken. Oh.
Yes.
On the surface of Free Cloud, we get a really fun descending establishing shot that is like just a feast for the Star Trek trivial mind. Like the Mott's Hair Emporium, the Quark's Bar. Really fun eye candy here.
Quark gets a couple of references in this episode. Like part of how they're running this op is that Raffi has been able to kind of gin up false paperwork for Captain Rios, who is going to be portraying a deal broker who is going to offer Vajazzle an alternative deal to the Tal Shiar one that she's trying to work on.
The storytelling in this episode pivots out of linear and into a sort of intercutting sequence here that also made me think of a lot of like Ocean's 11 and the way that those movies tell that story. Like we're describing the spy action in the present and also cutting to the future and back and forth. And if I'm not mistaken, Ben, I think this is something that Saw films do too.
Oh, really?
Right? Like we're in the room with the Saw, but we're cutting back to the investigation or the plan.
Oh, interesting.
Like, I think this is a quality of those films as well.
I have not watched any of those movies because they're too scary for me.
Yeah, I mean, you shouldn't. I'm not a fan, but I will admit to seeing some of them.
Wow. Yeah. Any tooth related scary thing is really not for me because when I was like 3 years old, I was like climbing on a boulder in Mosswood Park in Oakland, and I slipped and banged a tooth. And the entire genre of tooth trauma is just far too upsetting for me. And I think like the first trailer I saw for a Saw thing was somebody with their jaw wired shut. And I was just like, nope, 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 no.
It's so fucking weird to hear you tell that story and know without experiencing it what a tooth getting broken by a stone sounds like. Like, I don't know how I know that, but I know it. Ugh. Yeah. Gross.
I don't remember anything about it, but it definitely like is a formative trauma for me.
So Ben, let's see if we can describe what's going on here together, because there's a lot of jumping around and there's a lot of exposition here, like and a lot of terminology and jargon. So
yeah.
The idea of there needing to be a facer to broker a deal is a big part of it, because on a planet like Free Cloud, there's a lot of exchange type business happening, but you can't actually bring the real people to the planet to do these deals. You need a facer. A facer is the proxy for the deal being done, right?
Yeah, and so that's the role that Rios is going to play. He gets dressed up as a you know, like a groovy daddy with a, you know, crazy big hat and a fur coat and sunglasses. The role that Seven of Nine is going to play is that of bait,
mm-hmm.
because she knows that Vajazzle is a Borg pieces dealer, mm-hmm. and is going to be more interested in Seven of Nine's latent implants than she is in whatever deal she can get out of the Tal Shiar for Maddox.
Don't you believe the jumping around here in this sequence is an editing sleight of hand that is used to firewall the idea of cheese? Like, I think if we go through this scene linearly, instead of how mm-hmm. we get like the dress up scene and the prepare to go scene. And I think unfortunately we'd live with the pimp costume long enough to start laughing at it.
Right.
But because we're cutting around to the different characters and their motivations and we're getting the backstory and the jargon and stuff, I think there's really effective sleight of hand there to get you out of whatever cynicism you may feel for how cheesy this could be. I think it worked.
Well, they acknowledge the corniness in the dress-up parts of the scene.
Yeah.
But when you see him walking through the bar, blending right in.
Yeah.
like both standing out and blending in at the same time, you're like, oh, it's actually like kind of effective for the thing that they're describing in the
exactly
in the closed trion.
We need to be down in that club as soon as possible. As soon as we see these people in the costumes, we need to be there so that we don't sit in the cheese any longer than we have to.
Tell you what, Adam, that Temptibi Lagoon looks like my kind of drink.
Two umbrellas, though. How are you supposed to get in there for the sucking?
I don't know. But I like the idea that would be the specificity of your order. It's not shaken, not stirred. It's not a twist instead of an olive. It's, put a second cocktail umbrella in there.
You know, when I saw this order, my mind immediately went to Star Trek Las Vegas and how many people are going to absolutely waste those little paper umbrellas during the convention. Like, everyone's going to order two umbrellas. It's going to be an atrocity.
Here's the problem, Adam. That stupid hotel makes no effort to theme itself for the convention that's happening. So there won't be Temptibi Lagoons available for sale anyway.
Yeah, but they make a tiki drink there. That's what I'm saying. Like, that little tiki bar is gonna run out of umbrellas is what's going to happen.
I'm bringing my own umbrellas just to be safe. Mm. I mean, I always do.
So Vup is a really interesting character because he's got this hypersensitivity to smell that is so attenuated that he can smell you lying. He can smell your breakfast. He can smell who you're fucking. Like, yeah. He is the security system that they need to get around. And the mist sprayer that reveals the lasers in the room that they're trying to break into is the hypo spray that like shuts off Rios's pheromones for lying. That's so they pump him up with that before they send him down there.
Yeah. I got the sense that he was a little bit drugged because it does show him it kicking in on him.
I like that a lot.
This drug does help him pass the smell test. He convinces Vup that he really does have a tempting offer for Vup's employer.
I really think that Santiago Cabrera is doing the heavy lifting of this entire season. I mean, because he's acting drunk here, in addition to doing all the EMH stuff and playing his main character.
Yeah, like this is just got to be like the funnest gig for an actor
absolutely
to get offered.
Yeah.
Picard is having his own kind of fun, especially in this episode, playing the eye-patched French accented XB trafficker. And that's probably the silliest we've seen Picard ever act, right? When he's like doing a little bit of scenery chewing, talking about being appropriately sinister or whatever.
I wish I had a chance to know that Jean-Luc Picard.
I think he's played loud and flamboyant before, but you can tell he definitely relishes this moment as an actor.
Yeah. And then Seven of Nine's setup is that she gets Trick handcuffs. Mm-hmm. And Elnor's setup is that he gets a bomber jacket and no secret identity. He's really disappointed. But he's very new to this whole like world of deceiving people.
He is really innocent, and they're really leaning into making Elnor kind of the C-3PO of the crew. He's just sort of quippy and innocent.
Yeah, he's Ninja C-3PO.
Yeah, yeah. And the plan is once they get their hands on Bruce Maddox, Jurati is going to be on the La Serena ready to beam them out.
Right, and they have a little device. This bar is behind some shields, so they need a pattern-enhancing device to tunnel them back out at such time as they leave. And Jurati's going to be manning that station, which is a bit confusing until we discover that Raffi is saying her goodbyes here.
Yeah, we cut back in time to before this mission, and we see the goodbye that Raffi and Picard have in this scene. It seems like it's going to be a permanent deal.
Like, a big part of her resentment of Picard comes from the fact that her commitment to the mission of rescuing the Romulans came at the cost of her family. And, she took this big career move for that, you know, played directly into her talents and was a the right career move for her, and it fucking completely fell apart on them both in the end. But, you know, the cost, the emotional cost to her was way, way higher. And so this brief moment when they're on the transporter pad and he's saying, "I really sincerely hope you find what you're looking for," is really poignant, I thought.
Raffi is feeling this moment more than Picard in a way that that Laris felt Picard's departure more than he did back then. I think there's something tropey about an older character feeling wistful and overly emotional about their circumstances at any given time. Picard as a character does not feel like he's subject to that. Like I'm struggling to think of a moment on the Star Trek Picard show, especially where he's that vulnerable in these moments. He's very mission oriented.
Yeah. This guy left his dog behind without so much as a goodbye.
Yeah. I think one of my favorite shots in this whole episode is the ECU on Rios's pimp ring running the transporter. It's awesome. You don't see that very often on Star Trek.
The next scene is the emotions at 11 scene of Raffi reintroducing herself to her son, Gabe, who we get the sense she has not seen in a very long time. And
this is the person that she's been looking up over the course of the episode. She's been, you know, like when you walk into someone's cubicle and they minimize the window that they had up, like she does that a couple times this ep, and all of those screens show information on Gabriel.
I've seen this actor before in something, but I can't remember what it was.
Booksmart is what he was in, he's also the son of Cuba Gooding Jr.
No kidding.
Yeah. About that.
Wow.
Mason Gooding.
It surprised me to hear her say that she was clean. It implies that she's been addicted to something in a pathological way, which, you know, as far as we've ever known, has been mostly a solved problem in the Federation.
They were very subtle about her addiction in this episode. Like when that pop-up came up for the snake weed, she was very hostile about the pop-up, and she also chastised Rios for trying to light up his cigar in front of her in an earlier scene. And those were super subtle indications that she was like struggling to kick the habit and didn't need those kind of reminders.
I guess so.
But the problem to Gabriel is split. It's not only his mother's addiction, it's her addiction to conspiracy.
It's a hell of a combination.
Because it does not take very much at all for those accusations to be leveled, and then that really sets Raffi off.
It was a crackpot! That attack was not what it seemed!
And that's the tipping point. It elevates their conflict that they had many years ago into the now. Like, it totally stirs it back up again.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like the Romulan supernova potentially being, having been engineered, and the synth attack on Mars potentially having been engineered are both, you know, are both possibilities that are hovering over this entire series at this point.
Right.
And I'd be surprised if one or both of those weren't confirmed.
Right. And there's just the resentment, like betting the whole thing, Gabriel's resentment about a parent choosing anything besides being a parent to them as a priority is the foundation for it all. It matters specifically what she chose instead, but generally that's grounding all of it for them. It's that she chose someone besides him to care about.
You hear this shit all the time in TNG, like, oh, like, this is Starfleet. Like, they know the risks they signed up for. It's like, yeah, but your kid didn't sign up for it.
Right.
And there are a couple of episodes of TNG that, you know, tackle that idea. This is another version of that story. The duty over personal commitments having become a real point of pain in Gabriel's life.
The reunion does not go well, Enterprise. Like, things really go into the ditch here quickly. I mean, there's a moment where You know, often, like, if you're going to fight with someone, a third person will arrive and sort of diffuse it, because you're not going to fight in front of the other person. And this third person is the mother of Gabriel's child, and she's pregnant, and she emerges from an exam room, and it's like that awkwardness of, this is a person that Rafi's never met,
yeah,
carrying her grandchild.
Her Romulan daughter-in-law.
Yeah, carrying her grandchild, who clearly she, at this point in time, doesn't have a good chance of having a relationship with. And so there's that awkwardness of like, the daughter's like, well, are you going to stick around and have dinner? And Gabriel's like, nope, she's just on her way.
I am really worried about Gabriel's relationship with this woman because, you know, communication is key.
Yeah. I mean, that's something you talk about in the car on the way home, I think.
Yeah, you better.
Yeah.
Like, in my mind, that's like a fifth or sixth date conversation, not a, you know, you're in your fourth trimester and we're visiting the family planning clinic on FreeCloud conversation.
Yeah, like everything you know about FreeCloud would seem to indicate that, like, that's a place where you might not want to raise a family. So why are they there attempting to do that? Are they just on vacation having their baby moon, you think?
Yeah, maybe.
Huh. Good for them.
I don't know, man. Like, there's plenty of people living happy suburban lives in Las Vegas that don't ever go to the Strip. So,
yeah. Good point. Elsewhere, Bejazzle is inspecting the goods, and those goods are Seven. But she is someone that Bejazzle calls Annika, and this suggests a level of intimacy between them that is fairly surprising to the other people on this mission. But in just a second, it turns into a Mexican standoff. Like, as soon as you realize that this is happening, it's phasers drawn.
We're supposed to be fucking professionals.
Seven was using Picard to get to Bejazzle. And I just keep laughing at that.
Yeah. It's so crazy.
Yeah. She's here for one thing, Adam. She's here for Rwenge.
What does it mean?
It means omerta. It means Rwenge.
I want to hear Jonathan Frakes say that. Like, I know there's set footage of him directing actors, and you know he's using character names, and I just want to hear his voice say that word. And I want that to be the sound that plays when I get a text message, even though my phone is on permanent vibrate and will never make a sound ever, ever. On the ship, something very important happens here. It's that we learn that the EMH appears when it senses physical distress from someone on the ship. And so, as Dr. Girardi is freaking out about shit going down on the surface, the EMH shows up and is like, hey, you seem stressed out. What can I do?
Its assessment of what's going on with her almost makes it back to the actual Captain Rios,
right,
before she shuts it down. And it seems like Dr. Girardi may have something to hide. This seems more like more than just nerves about working the transport.
Right. Right, and Rios is trying to kind of calm her down because, you know, her ability to beam them back is sort of mission critical at this point.
Yeah.
And she's so flustered that she's not using good radio jargon.
So Picard is able to talk Seven of Nine off the precipice by, you know, making the moral case against revenge. But the thing that really really gets her to take a step back from what she's about to do is Captain Rios going like, hey, actually, like, from a tactical standpoint, we are really going to be fucked if you do this revenge right now, because, you know, the people that work with Bejazzle are going to be pissed and come after us all. So please don't do the revenge. And so, you know, cooler heads prevail.
It's a conversation that happens while Seven's hand is around Bejazzle's throat.
Yes. And so the logistical problem of revenge prevents her from doing it.
So as Seven and Picard are arguing over the relative value of revenge, I think there's a really interesting visual language happening here. We're cutting from light to dark backgrounds, right? When we cut over to Seven, she's very strongly backlit. And Picard is in the dark. And I think that's not suggesting a way of being, like, in a good or evil kind of way. It's suggesting a level of knowledge, right? As in, Seven has all the knowledge and Picard is in the dark.
Yeah, I think that's true. They get everyone out of there. They beam back up to the ship with Maddox. And Seven of Nine is like, hey, thanks for getting me there. Sorry, I went a little crazy down there. And Picard's like, well, no problem. Like, we all got through it. Do you need a ride? And she says, no, the Rangers are coming to pick me up. So I will take a couple of your phasers, but I don't need to go with you. And he's like, oh, you know, take anything you need. And she has stuck the pattern enhancer in her pocket, and it enables her to beam right back down to the bar where she starts wasting Bajazzle's guards.
This is the moment that you wanted from the start, not just Seven's application of revenge, but that moment of intimacy between Picard and Seven where they both agree that they've never been the same since, and it's a struggle every day. I really love that scene.
Yeah, and I really liked in the score when she beams down, there's a little dusting of the Voyager theme as she beams off the ship.
Bajazzle gets her bad guy monologue, and Seven blows her away because her rifles are set to gore.
Yeah, her rifles are set to campfire.
Oof.
That is a rough way to go out.
It's the last we see Seven, and I hope she's not dead. I hope she comes back. You don't know at this point, though. She's got enough firepower to get out of this club, I think.
Did you like how all the banquet tables in this bar look like the Vince Lombardi trophy?
Mm-hmm. I did like that. Yeah.
Well, in the six bay on the La Serena, we get a little conversation between Maddox and Picard. Little information transmitted back and forth. Maddox learns that Daj is in fact dead, which he had assumed to be the case when the Tal Shiar showed up to destroy his lab. He tells Picard where he can find Soji and discusses the embedded mom AI, which is what we saw Daj talking to in that first episode, and Soji's talked to as well. So
that was a great detail.
That AI seems to be the governing program that determines whether or not one of these androids gets activated.
Right. I dug that quite a bit.
The visual language of this scene is that Jurati is like off in the corner overhearing this conversation in growing horror.
Right. As soon as mention of the sister comes up, we basically cut to Jurati eavesdropping.
Yeah. The androids have been looking for the truth behind the ban. One of the main mysteries of this season. And Maddox thinks the Federation may have been involved in addition to the Tal Shiar. So some bad shit is happening.
Yeah.
But maybe the baddest shit is that after Picard leaves, Jurati wastes him.
Yeah.
She says she has to atone for something.
In front of the EMH, basically, which makes it even more rugged.
Yeah. She must have had a much longer hang with Commodore O than we actually got to see.
I felt exactly the same way because she starts spouting off about, like, I wish they hadn't shown me. You'd never believe if you'd seen what I'd seen, and you'd feel differently if you know what I know. Like, there's only one scene in this entire series where something like that could have happened. And so the realization that Jurati might have been placed there by O as a mole or a sleeper in her own right really changes the game.
Changes the game. I mean, like, I think Jurati's motivation to come having to do with loving Bruce Maddox was explanation of enough. And it's pretty devastating to see the switcheroo that's happened here.
RSVP Bruce Maddox, Ben.
Yeah. He achieved his dream, though, right? He got himself a Soong-type android.
Yeah, you know, he says something to Jurati. It's like, we couldn't do it without you, or I think he said something about her being essential.
Your contribution was essential.
And what do you think that means specifically?
Well, I know because I read the book.
Lay it on me.
The cloning of a positronic neuron was her, like, PhD dissertation and gave him the inspiration for what came next. Like, one thing about that book that, like, makes Jurati's character seem a little strange is that she seems so disconnected from the Mars attack element of it. Like, if you could imagine like the, like it came out in the news that the architect and engineer that put the World Trade Center up disappeared after 9/11.
Right.
Like, you know, there's enough conspiracy theories about 9/11 as it is, but if that had happened, people would be fucking mental about it. And the fact that she was like the, you know, like her boyfriend was the guy that designed the synths and also disappeared immediately after the synthetic thing was shut down is like, maybe strains credulity a little bit.
Did you like the episode?
I'm still with this, and I still like the episode. I thought that this was a unique and fun episode, and I really liked Frakes' direction. I wonder if they're going to go. They said that at the premiere that the season was kind of broken up into chapters, mm-hmm. which is why they showed the first three episodes as chapter one, and that was all Hanley Culpepper directing. So I wonder how many episodes chapter two is and how meant and if they're all directed by Frakes or what.
Yeah.
Did you like the episode, Adam?
Yeah, I really did. Ben, was there ever any mention of lore in that book? Because I'm starting to wonder whether or not there is a deus ex machina waiting for us that we haven't been introduced to yet. Because like that seems to be when we're talking about all the androids being twinned up,
yeah.
like whatever happened to that body? That the last time we saw him, he was on the D. Did he die on Viridian? Did he survive and was he put into another drawer somewhere else?
Yeah.
Is he the puppet master for this whole thing somewhere?
I don't know.
I mean, with the death of Bruce Maddox, I'm now wondering, like, are the synthetics now totally independent and just running off of the last order they were given without any sort of puppet master? And what does that mean about their mission? Like, should Soji uncover the thing her mission is mandating? What then? Who does she take it to?
Right. Yeah. Interesting questions.
Yeah. I mean, that's all to say that yeah, I mean, I did like the episode quite a bit. It was interesting how little of, like, this was all a story. Like, we never cut away from our five crew people at all, basically. And I thought the episode was better for it. I think it was a lot of story to tell in 45 minutes, and I don't think there was any room for anything else. Really good story and performances all around. I dug it.
You know what we do have room for, Adam?
Oh, yeah?
It's a couple of Priority One messages. You want to check the inbox with me?
Always do.
Priority One message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Ben, our first Priority One message is from Andrew, his face palmed, and it is for Ben and Adam.
Oh, I get it. It's communication in metaphor.
Yes. The message goes like this. It me, I Shimoda Tillied the asking of my P1 question and ended up just a little bit embarrassed on the first ep of Picard. My incoherence was without honor. But thank you both for your perfect answers. Message goes on. So, who would win in a fight between 10 Defiants, 10 Big D's, and 10 Discos? Also, who was farther gone, Feral Culber or Feral Riker? Well, I think I could answer the second one easier than the first. Feral Culber or Feral Riker? I mean, that Riker's beard is the tie-breaking element to this whole thing. I mean, Riker's just got a great big bushy beard going, and Culber has like the sort of rugged, manly kind of chalky, awesome stubble that like I wish I could have but never will.
Yeah.
I think that's where I'm at on that question. What about you, Ben?
I would put my money on the 10 little D's, right? Because it's like more emphatically a warship than the big D or the
right.
Or and the Discovery is just old. Like, it's probably best in breed or just shy of best in breed in its time and place, but it's not in its time and place anymore.
I gotta say, and it pains me to say it, when a hella old Klingon bird of prey is the thing that takes you out, like, reputationally, yeah. I don't know if the Big D recovers from that. So I guess I'm gonna go, like, reduction, right? I'm striking through 10 Big D's for that reason, and I think I'm striking through 10 Discos just for, like, aging technology. I think the answer's obvious. It's 10 Defiants.
I guess the disco would have an edge if you could convince Stamets to do the crazy jump around attack pattern.
Right.
That they do in that one episode of Disco. Maybe the disco would have an edge, but that seemed to be a one and done kind of deal for him.
That's a great call. Like, strategically, you may have an upper hand there if you've got someone like Stamets on your side. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Adam, our next Priority One message here is from Castilian Spanish Siri, and it is for Vichy French Guy.
Mm.
Oh, boy. It goes like this. Your surrender to that Vath is muy de Toronto. Speak to me of war crimes, do you? I accuse you of revisionismo historico atroz. Our generalissimo signed a pact of neutrality. He did not cower in fear like you pusillanimous Gallic sinvergüenzas.
Mm.
Say hola to your wife for me. Wow.
I'm really glad you got that one, TBH.
Yeah, that was hard, and I did a bad job also.
You did great.
Well, if you'd like to throw an impression curveball at us, head to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. It's $100 for a personal message and $200 for a commercial message. And we'd really appreciate it, because it doesn't look like we're going to be able to place ads on this series in time to take advantage of the listener bump we got from Star Trek Picard. So we need alternate forms of funding to keep this going.
And lucky you, because you're getting what equates to an advertisement for the low max fun price. So there you go.
Squarespace. Got to build yourself a website if you want to stand out online. Social media websites are not cutting it anymore, and you really can't tell the story of what you do and sell your products or services or time effectively without a really great looking website. Squarespace is the way to do it. Using Squarespace Blueprint, you can choose from professionally curated layout and styling options. You make a seamless checkout option for your customers. You can accept PayPal, Apple Pay, and in eligible countries offer customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and ClearPay. Amazing. So head to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/trek to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
It's Webby season. Hi, I'm Sequoia Holmes, host of the Black People Love Paramore podcast, and we are nominated for a Webby for the episode where I interviewed Hayley Williams. In case you're unfamiliar, Black People Love Paramore is a podcast delving into the common and uncommon interests of Black people in order to help us feel more seen. We would love your vote to help us win this Webby. Please take a second, go over to the Black People Love Paramore podcast social media accounts, and you can find them at BPLP Pod across all social media platforms. Hit the link in bio and vote for Black People Love Paramore.
Hi, I'm Travis McElroy.
And I'm Teresa McElroy.
And we're the host of Schmanners.
We don't believe that etiquette should be used to judge other people.
No, on Schmanners, we see etiquette as a way to navigate social situations with confidence.
So if that sounds like something you're into,
join us every Friday on Maximum Fun, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Ben.
What's that, Adam?
Did you discover yourself and Edward Larkin?
I did. I'm giving it to Elnor. I love the way that he played his inability to act in a deceptive manner. He's just like culturally so alien to him. And I really thought that was fun. And I feel like he is just coiling up like a snake in this episode. Like, you can tell he wants to fucking cut somebody's head off, but he doesn't get his opportunity because other things go down.
I love that background acting he does when Seven appears and like he's got the sword ready, and
yeah,
you actually see to the extreme left side of the frame Picard like waves him off.
Yeah. And I love when he gets the two pistols and goes up to the other women that are providing muscle for Vajazzle. Just like his swagger is really fun and good, and he seemed like he was having a lot of fun in this episode.
he's got that lethal Lenny energy where he's sort of like fish out of water and not contextually wise, but lethal in every other way. I think that's going to be a fun thing to experience going forward.
Yeah. Did you have an Edward Larkin?
I referred to this earlier, and I promise I'm not putting my thumb on the scale of how this is going to come out of the wash at the end of the season. But I mean, Santiago Cabrera, again.
Like, is that a hat trick for him from you?
It's a literal hat trick with two feathers sticking out of it, man. I don't know how you take a person seriously wearing that hat. And yet, it's like I didn't even see it.
Yeah.
I think he's a special actor.
That hat would wear almost anybody, and he wore it.
Yeah, exactly. I can't give my Edward Larkin to anyone else. He's killing it right now. Big ups. And to think that he walked around that Star Trek party unnoticed because he wasn't in basically the first three episodes. Like, God, it would have been cool to hang out with him and figure out what his deal was, because really, really great actor. Yeah. Big fan.
Really enjoying his work.
Are we going to enjoy the next episode, Bennett? Episode 6 of Star Trek Picard. What did the preview indicate to you?
Well, we saw the artifact. It seems like that's where they're headed at the end of this. And it's kind of a behind enemy lines type deal from what I gathered. It seems like they're there on a sort of unsanctioned way. They don't pass through customs or passport control. They are trying to reach Soji, who seems to be in some kind of gas chamber and maybe punching her way out. So maybe this is the episode she gets activated.
Whoa, yeah.
And I caught a glimpse of Locutus in the little preview. So
I was wondering if that was him. I tried to freeze frame it a couple of times, and it was ambiguous to me. You're pretty sure it's him, huh?
Seemed like it.
Wow.
Or intentionally confusing. So
this just turns into a show where everyone dresses up in costumes every episode. Picard's like, "Oh, this is the one walk down the staircase in front of everyone I was really hoping to avoid."
Well, I'm really looking forward to it, and it will be next week on The Greatest Discovery. Let's leave it with Robs from here.
Thanks, Robs.
The Greatest Discovery is a Maximum Fun podcast hosted by Adam Pranica and Ben Harrison. The show is produced and edited by me, Rob Schulte. Our theme music is produced by Friend of DeSoto and YouTube sensation Adam Ragusea. The Greatest Discovery is a podcast that's made possible by the support of listeners like you. To make sure that we continue to make episodes, visit MaximumFun.org/join and pledge your support. By doing so, you'll gain access to all of the Maximum Fun bonus content, including our bonus episodes. If you want to chat about the show on various forms of social media, just search for our discussion groups or use the hashtag #GreatestDiscovery. You can find Ben on Twitter at BenjaminAHR. Adam's found at Cut for Time, and I'm at Rob K. Schulte. Thanks.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.